Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Weekly Rundown for the week of March 23, 2026. We're covering 30 studies across arthroplasty, sports, hand, foot, ankle, shoulder, elbow, trauma, basic science, spine, and pediatrics. Let's start with our first study. Louis and colleagues published in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Subjective and Functional Dysphagia After Anterior Cervical Spine Surgery, a prospective controlled study. This prospective controlled study enrolled 134 patients. 67 undergoing cervical surgery and 67 lumbar controls, and tracked them over 30 days at 5 time points, preoperatively, and then postoperative days 0, 3, 7, and 30. The researchers quantified dysphagia incidence and time course after anterior cervical discectomy infusion or cervical disc replacement, up to 3 levels, using ET10 scores and the Yale Swallow Protocol, with lumbar decompression patients serving as controls. This work extends the prior literature on ACDF dysphagia incidence, which has varied wildly from 1.7 to 71%, by providing a controlled, prospective, multi-time point characterization with objective swallowing assessment and radiographic retropharyngeal measurements, moving well beyond single time point retrospective incidence reporting. One limitation: follow-up ends at 30 days, leaving the natural history of the 35.8% of cervical patients still symptomatic at postoperative day 30 uncharacterized. Consider dysphagia after ACDF as a common self-limited symptom rather than a true complication, given that 70.1% of patients experienced it on postoperative day 0, but only 35.8% remained symptomatic by day 30, compared to just 13.4% and 4.5% in lumbar controls. Moving on. Mova and colleagues published in JAOS, titled Isolating the Effect of Surgeon Experience on Spine Surgery Outcomes, a retrospective cohort study stratified by procedure type. This retrospective cohort tracked 3,649 patients across 3 common spine procedures, 1,567 undergoing ACDF, 248 undergoing posterior cervical decompression and fusion, and 1,834 undergoing lumbar fusion at a multi-site academic center from 2003 to 2023. The study asked whether surgeon experience independently predicts surgical outcomes across these 3 procedures. This extends prior work on experience effects in scoliosis correction and total disc arthroplasty by demonstrating that the experience-outcome relationship is procedure-specific. Experience matters for lumbar fusion and posterior cervical decompression and fusion, but not for ACDF, suggesting that procedural complexity and anatomical variability modulate the learning curve effect rather than experience being a universal quality metric. One limitation: surgeon experience is measured as years in practice rather than procedure-specific case volume, making it impossible to distinguish true skill acquisition from secular trends in technique, implant design, and infection control over the 20-year period. Each additional year of surgeon experience reduces long-term complication odds by 17% in lumbar fusion and 29% in posterior cervical decompression and fusion, but confers no benefit for ACDF outcomes. Moving on, Krebix and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled Gait Function at 20 Years or More After Rotationplasty, shows pseudo-knee motion, decreased walking speed, and increased energy cost of walking. This prospective cohort evaluated gait function in 29 rotationplasty patients at a median follow-up of 33 years, comparing them to 27 to 38 age, sex, and body mass index matched controls. The study assessed walking speed, energy cost, and spatiotemporal and kinetic parameters in patients who had undergone Winkelmann type A1 rotationplasty. This extends prior rotationplasty functional outcome series by providing long-term gait characterization in a mature cohort. One limitation: survivorship bias from 37% tumor-related mortality in the original cohort means the analyzed patients represent the healthiest survivors, likely overestimating long-term gait performance. At median 33-year follow-up after rotationplasty, patients walked at 1.2 meters per second with an energy cost of 4.4 joules per kilogram per meter, 26% slower and 26% more energy costly than controls, yet still below the energy expenditure typically reported after transfemoral amputation. Moving on, Oppenheim and colleagues published in AJSM, titled Arthroscopic Findings After Osteochondral Allografts of the Knee, Proposed Classification Scheme and Associations with Graft Failure. This retrospective case series characterized macroscopic osteochondral allograft appearance at second-look arthroscopy in 129 grafts from 127 patients, drawn from a cohort of 1,152 OCAs. The mean time to second-look procedure was 2.20 years, and mean time to revision reconstruction was 3.14 years. The researchers proposed a classification distinguishing non-failing from failing grafts using outer bridge grade 3 or 4 degeneration or greater than 2 millimeter peripheral delamination as structural failure criteria. This extends prior work by Grassatelli and colleagues. One limitation: the second look cohort represents only symptomatic patients requiring reoperation, just 11.2% of all OCAs, making it impossible to determine whether the 32.6% structural failure rate reflects true incidence or is substantially overestimated by indication bias. At second look arthroscopy after knee osteochondral allograft transplantation, 32.6% of grafts met structural failure criteria at a mean of 3.17 years, and structural failure was strongly correlated with clinical failure. Moving on, Zhang and colleagues published an injury titled Proximal Forearm Antegrade Elastic Stable Intramedullary Nailing for Pediatric Distal Radius Metaphyseal-Diaphyseal Junction Fractures, a modified technique. This retrospective cohort compared proximal forearm antegrade elastic stable intramedullary nailing versus retrograde crossed K-wire fixation for pediatric distal radius metaphyseal-diaphyseal junction fractures in 79 children, 38 treated with antegrade eSIN and 41 with retrograde K-wires, with minimum 12 months of follow-up. This extends the established evidence base for eSIN in pediatric long bone fractures by demonstrating that an antegrade proximal forearm entry point specifically addresses the technical challenge of metaphyseal-diaphyseal junction-level distal radius fractures, where retrograde entry risks physial violation and provides insufficient purchase. One limitation: retrospective design without randomization means fracture complexity and surgeon selection bias cannot be excluded as confounders. Antegrade eSIN reduced open reduction rate from 36.6 to 10.5% and achieved excellent or good forearm rotation in 92.1% versus 65.9% compared to retrograde crossed K-wires. Moving on. Costa and colleagues published in Foot and Ankle International, titled Medial Malleolar Osteotomy: The Influence of Two Types of Osteotomies and Two Fixation Methods on Articular Displacement in Fresh Frozen Cadaveric Specimens. This cadaveric study compared oblique versus chevron medial malleolar osteotomies with 2 versus 3 screw fixation across 4 groups of 10 specimens each, measuring articular step-off with a digital caliper after talus removal. The study included 40 specimens, with 1 excluded due to intraoperative fracture. This extends the existing literature on medial malleolar osteotomy access for Taylor dome osteochondral lesions. One limitation: static cadaveric measurement without cyclic loading or weight-bearing simulation cannot confirm whether observed displacement differences persist under in vivo mechanical conditions. Chevron medial malleolar osteotomy fixed with 3 screws produced 0 measurable articular displacement versus a 50% step-off rate with oblique osteotomy and 2 screw fixation. Moving on, Lehman and colleagues published in AJSM, titled Risk of Revision and Reoperation After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, Comparison of Quadriceps Tendon, Patellar Tendon, and Hamstring Autografts, Stratified by Patient Sex and Age, a cohort study of 27,715 patients from 2012 to 2023. This Kaiser Permanente Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Registry cohort compared revision and reoperation risks across quadriceps tendon, patellar tendon, and hamstring tendon autografts in 27,715 primary isolated anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction patients stratified by sex and age, under 22 versus 22 and older. The registry period spanned 2012 to 2023. This extends the Bayer trial and the broader graft selection literature by demonstrating that sex and age are critical effect modifiers of revision risk, specifically identifying young females as the subgroup where hamstring autograft is most disadvantaged relative to bone-containing or quadriceps tendon grafts. One limitation: individual patient follow-up duration is not reported, making it impossible to assess whether revision risk differences persist or converge beyond the registry observation window. In females under 22, hamstring autograft carries 2.3 times higher revision risk versus quadriceps tendon and 1.8 times higher versus patellar tendon after anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. Moving on, Smith and colleagues published in AJSM, titled Combined Root and Body Lateral Meniscus Tears in the Adolescent Population: An Under-Recognized and Under-Reported Tear Pattern. This retrospective case-control study characterized the incidence and associations of crab tears, simultaneous posterior root and radial body tears of the lateral meniscus, in 227 adolescents undergoing primary anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction at a single pediatric center from 2021 to 2022. This extends the Issikos meniscal tear classification framework, which categorizes root tears and radial tears as distinct entities by identifying a co-occurring dual tear pattern not previously described as a discrete injury type in the skeletally immature anterior cruciate ligament injured population. One limitation: no functional outcomes or repair data are reported, so the clinical consequence of missed versus treated crab tears on meniscal biomechanics and joint preservation remains unknown. Combined root and body crab lateral meniscus tears occur in 10.1% of adolescent anterior cruciate ligament reconstructions and were missed by radiologists in 74% of cases preoperatively. Moving on, Murakami and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Increased Preoperative Lateral Anterior Tibial Subluxation by Magnetic Resonance Imaging, is associated with increased knee laxity after anatomical anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. This retrospective cohort of 208 patients examined whether preoperative MRI measured anterior tibial subluxation predicts postoperative anterior tibial subluxation and residual instability after anatomical anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction using bone patellar tendon bone or double bundle hamstring grafts with minimum 2 years postoperative MRI follow-up. This extends the established literature linking preoperative tibial subluxation to anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction outcomes by quantifying preoperative MRI-measured anterior tibial subluxation as an independent continuous predictor of postoperative instability metrics, including pivot shift, rather than treating it as a binary threshold variable. One limitation: retrospective design with mixed graft types prevents determination of whether graft selection modifies the relationship between preoperative anterior tibial subluxation and postoperative instability. Preoperative lateral anterior tibial subluxation on MRI independently predicts postoperative lateral anterior tibial subluxation, and postoperative lateral anterior tibial subluxation correlates with residual pivot shift after anatomical anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. Moving on, Stevens and colleagues published in JSES, titled Clinical Outcomes of Total Shoulder Arthroplasty in Patients with Prior Cervical Fusion. This matched retrospective study compared total shoulder arthroplasty outcomes in 56 patients with prior cervical fusion versus 56 controls matched for age, sex, body mass index, diagnosis, and procedure type with minimum 24 months of follow-up. This extends the established understanding of shoulder spine syndrome by demonstrating that prior cervical fusion does not preclude equivalent functional gains after total shoulder arthroplasty, though absolute TSA scores remain lower in the fusion cohort. One limitation: the anatomic TSA subgroup of 13 patients per arm is critically underpowered, making the statistically significant absolute score differences unreliable. Prior cervical fusion did not reduce the magnitude of functional improvement after total shoulder arthroplasty, though anatomic TSA patients with prior fusion had lower absolute postoperative ASES scores of 76.3 versus 91.7 compared to matched controls. Moving on, Hashimoto and colleagues published in JOA, titled The 10 to 23 Year Outcomes of Cemented Total Hip Arthroplasty Utilizing Impaction Bone Grafting for Severe Acetabular Bone Defects in Osteoarthritis and Rheumatoid Arthritis. This retrospective cohort evaluated primary cemented total hip arthroplasty with impaction bone grafting and metal mesh containment for severe acetabular defects in OA and RA patients at a single Japanese center from 2000 to 2015, enrolling 102 hips in 99 patients. Mean follow-up was 12.8 years, with 66 hips reaching 10 years, 33 reaching 15 years, and 14 reaching 20 years. This extends the Poprosky acetabular classification framework by demonstrating that cemented impaction bone grafting achieves durable fixation in complex defects without the structural augments or cup cage constructs typically recommended for these patterns, and supports prior European impaction bone grafting series by replicating these results in a primary Asian developmental dysplasia of the hip predominant cohort. One limitation: only 14 hips reach 20-year follow-up, making survivorship estimates beyond 15 years statistically underpowered. Cemented total hip arthroplasty with impaction bone grafting for severe acetabular defects achieved 100% survivorship free of aseptic loosening at 10 and 15 years, with zero cup revisions for loosening at mean 12.8-year follow-up. Moving on, Sullivan and colleagues published in JOAT, titled The Effect of Preoperative Tranexamic Acid on Blood Transfusions in Geriatric Hip Fracture Surgery, a Randomized Controlled Trial. This double-blinded randomized controlled trial evaluated whether a single preoperative IV tranexamic acid dose reduces postoperative transfusion rates in 283 patients aged 65 and older undergoing operative hip fracture treatment, either arthroplasty or internal fixation, with 90 days of follow-up. This extends the FAITH trial sub-analysis by demonstrating that pharmacologic blood conservation with tranexamic acid does not offset procedure-specific transfusion risk, reinforcing that surgical technique and fracture type are the primary drivers of blood loss in this population. One limitation: early termination for futility means the trial was underpowered to detect a clinically meaningful but modest tranexamic acid effect. Preoperative IV tranexamic acid did not reduce postoperative transfusion rates versus placebo in geriatric hip fracture surgery, with 81% transfusion-free in both groups. Moving on, Spiridon and colleagues published an OTSR titled Septic Tibial Plateau Non-Union Leads to Poor Outcomes and Frequent Salvage Procedures, a long-term cohort study. This retrospective cohort from a national fracture-related infection referral center evaluated long-term outcomes in 28 adults with septic tibial plateau non-union treated between 2002 and 2023, with mean follow-up of 8.1 years. The FDA and Diamond Concept Framework for Non-Union Management and the Fracture-Related Infection Consensus Criteria underpin the diagnostic and treatment approach here. This extends that literature by demonstrating that even protocol-adherent, multidisciplinary fracture-related infection management yields reconstructive success in fewer than 1 in 5 patients when the tibial plateau is the non-union site. A failure rate substantially worse than reported for diaphyseal septic non-unions. One limitation, the 21-year inclusion window spans substantial evolution in fracture-related infection management protocols, implant technology, and antibiotic strategies, making the cohort internally heterogeneous. Septic tibial plateau non-union required salvage procedures in 82% of patients, with only 18% achieving union and infection remission without major intervention at mean 8.1-year follow-up. Moving on, Ibunig and colleagues published in Acta Orthopedica, titled An Acta Orthopedica Educational Article, Treatment of Adult Patients with a Humeral Shaft Fracture. This educational review synthesizes current evidence and expert opinion on humeral shaft fracture management across non-surgical and surgical modalities. This extends the AO Foundation and Orthopedic Trauma Association classification framework and established operative thresholds, apex angulation greater than 20 degrees, varus or valgus greater than 30 degrees, shortening greater than 3 centimeters, by contextualizing them within a cost-effectiveness and shared decision-making model that prioritizes working-age patients for surgical intervention. One limitation, as an expert opinion integrated narrative review without systematic literature search methodology, its recommendations cannot be distinguished from consensus-based guidance. Functional bracing achieves good long-term outcomes for humeral shaft fractures, but carries non-union rates up to 25%, while surgical fixation reduces non-union risk at the cost of iatrogenic radial nerve palsy risk. Moving on, Olerud and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled Acute or Delayed Total Knee Arthroplasty for Tibial Plateau Fracture, an Observational Study from the Swedish Arthroplasty Register. This retrospective cohort compared reoperation and revision rates between acute total knee arthroplasty performed within 3 months of injury and delayed total knee arthroplasty for tibial plateau fracture sequelae using Swedish Arthroplasty Register data from 2014 to 2023, enrolling 1,102 patients, 152 undergoing acute TKA and 950 undergoing delayed TKA. 5-year cumulative event probabilities were reported. This extends the Schatzker classification literature on complex tibial plateau fracture management by quantifying implant-specific failure modes when total knee arthroplasty is used acutely versus after fracture sequelae. One limitation, implant constraint level, a major determinant of loosening risk, could not be adjusted for in regression models because it is collinear with the clinical indication, leaving residual confounding. Acute total knee arthroplasty for tibial plateau fracture carries a 4.8-fold higher adjusted odds of loosening-related revision compared to delayed total knee arthroplasty, though overall 5-year revision rates are similar at 8 versus 5%. Moving on, Santam and colleagues published in JSES titled Cannabis Use Disorder is Associated with Increased Early Postoperative Opioid Use and Pain but No Long-Term Differences After Arthroscopic Rotator Cuff Repair, a retrospective cohort study using TriNetX. This study used the TriNetX database to compare 90-day and 2-year outcomes after arthroscopic rotator cuff repair in 3,012 matched pairs of patients with versus without a cannabis use disorder diagnosis within 3 months preoperatively. This extends prior work associating cannabis use disorder with increased postoperative opioid consumption in general surgical populations by demonstrating that this effect is time-limited to the first 42 days after rotator cuff repair and does not translate into worse 2-year structural or functional outcomes. One limitation, ICD-coded cannabis use disorder captures only clinically documented disorder, excluding the far larger population of regular cannabis users without a formal diagnosis. Cannabis use disorder before arthroscopic rotator cuff repair is associated with 17% higher early opioid use rates, 42.0 versus 35.9%, and fewer physical therapy visits within 90 days, but no difference in 2-year complications or revision rates. Moving on. Gao and colleagues published in Arthroscopy titled Primary Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Using Hamstring Autograft in the Setting of Adult Irreducible Tibial Eminence Fracture renders comparable outcomes to suture fixation in reducible cases. This retrospective comparative study asked whether primary hamstring autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction for irreducible tibial eminence fractures produces outcomes equivalent to suture fixation for reducible fractures, with treatment allocation determined intraoperatively. The cohort included 74 patients, 31 undergoing anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction and 43 undergoing suture fixation, with mean follow-up of 77 months. This extends the body of evidence on tibial eminence fracture management. One limitation: the anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction group had a mean time to surgery nearly 10 months longer than the suture fixation group, reflecting a fundamentally different clinical presentation that likely confounds outcome comparisons. Primary hamstring autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction for irreducible tibial eminence fractures achieves equivalent Tegner, Lishom, and IKDC scores, an 85.1% patient acceptable symptomatic state compared to suture fixation at mean 77-month follow-up. Moving on. Cardinale and colleagues published in OTSR titled Surgical Management of Femur Basic Cervical Fractures, AO Foundation, Orthopedic Trauma Association 31B3, a systematic review. This PRISMA-compliant systematic review evaluated compression hip screw, sliding hip screw, and hemiarthroplasty outcomes for strictly defined AO Foundation and Orthopedic Trauma Association 31B3 basic cervical fractures across 16 studies, enrolling 1,144 patients. This extends Reindl's 2015 work, which established intramedullary nailing superiority for unstable intertrochanteric fractures broadly, by demonstrating that for the anatomically distinct basic cervical subtype, compression hip screw and sliding hip screw show comparable failure rates when reduction quality is controlled, suggesting the intertrochanteric intramedullary nail advantage does not straightforwardly transfer to this borderline fracture pattern. One limitation: the hemiarthroplasty cohort comprised only 60 highly selected patients across all 16 studies, making any comparison of arthroplasty failure rates to internal fixation statistically underpowered. In 1,144 strictly defined AO Foundation and Orthopedic Trauma Association 31B3 basic cervical fractures, implant failure rates were 6.5% for compression hip screw, 8.1% for sliding hip screw, and 3.3% for hemiarthroplasty, with no statistically superior fixation strategy identified. Moving on. Sugiura and colleagues published in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery titled The Trapezius Aponeurosis Insertion on the Acromion, an anatomical study with a possible implication for dynamic stabilization of the acromioclavicular joint. This cadaveric study characterized the regional anatomy of the trapezius aponeurosis insertion around the AC joint using macroscopic measurement, fiber orientation coherency analysis, and histology in 20 shoulders from 13 donors, 21 collected, with one excluded for osteoarthritis. This extends the work of Matsuoka and colleagues. One limitation: the exclusively elderly cadaveric cohort with mean age 86 years may not reflect the aponeurosis dimensions, fiber organization, or enthesis integrity relevant to the younger athletic population sustaining acute AC dislocations. The trapezius aponeurosis inserts longest at the acromion at a mean of 28.9 millimeters, forms a fibrocartilaginous enthesis just posterior to the AC joint, and creates a contiguous complex with the deltoid origin and superior AC capsule that may be the anatomical basis for dynamic AC joint stabilization. Moving on, Boutini and colleagues published an injury titled Nutritional Vulnerability Predicts Complications in Patients with Femoral Shaft Fractures. This database study used the TriNetX Research Network across 112 healthcare organizations to determine whether laboratory-defined malnutrition independently predicts complications after operative femoral shaft fracture fixation, comparing 10,943 propensity score matched malnourished and non-malnourished adults. Follow-up included 90 days for acute complications and 2 years for fracture-related complications. This extends the perioperative optimization literature on modifiable risk factors by demonstrating that a simple, routinely available laboratory marker stratifies infectious and reoperative risks specifically in femoral shaft fracture patients. One limitation: the retrospective database design cannot confirm that malnutrition preceded the fracture event, rather than reflecting acute phase hypoalbuminemia from the injury. Laboratory-defined malnutrition, albumin 3.5 grams per deciliter or less, and or leukocytes 1.5 times 10 to the third per microliter or less, was associated with a 2.29-fold increased risk of acute respiratory failure and 2.43-fold increased risk of osteomyelitis after femoral shaft fracture fixation. Moving on. Moon and colleagues published an injury titled Association Between Time to Weight Bearing and Rates of Non-Union, Delayed Union, and Malunion After Intramedullary Nailing of Tibial Shaft Fractures. This retrospective cohort of 433 fractures asked whether time to weight bearing as tolerated after tibial shaft intramedullary nail predicts non-union, delayed union, or malunion across two Level 1 trauma centers from 2010 to 2021, with minimum 6 months of follow-up. This extends the work of Sarmiento and colleagues. One limitation: confounding by indication is the critical flaw. The decision to delay weight-bearing was surgeon-directed and likely correlated with fracture instability, soft tissue compromise, and patient compliance, variables not fully controlled in the regression model. Each week of delay in weight-bearing as tolerated after tibial shaft intramedullary nail independently increases non-union odds by 7%, with mean time to weight-bearing 8.3 weeks in union versus 13.7 weeks in non-union cases. Moving on, Wang and colleagues published in JHS, titled Repairing Chronic Tendinous Mallet Finger by Brachioradialis Tendon Bone Graft. This case series evaluated brachioradialis tendon bone graft reconstruction in 10 patients with chronic tendinous mallet finger, injury to surgery interval ranging from 3 months to 14 years, who failed non-surgical management, including two with swan neck deformity, with follow-up of 3 to 5 years. This extends the standard of care for chronic mallet finger, which per Verdenzone classification accepts primary repair or splinting acutely, but lacks consensus on reconstruction beyond 3 months, by introducing a bone-bone healing interface as a mechanistic rationale for improved fixation durability. One limitation: the series of 10 patients with heterogeneous injury to surgery intervals and no comparative cohort makes it impossible to determine which patient subgroup benefits most. Brachioradialis tendon bone graft reconstruction of chronic tendinous mallet finger achieved Crawford excellent or good outcomes in all 10 patients, with mean dip active range of motion of 82 degrees at 3 to 5 year follow-up. Moving on, Wine and colleagues published in KSSTA, titled A Rehabilitation Program Performed in Darkness After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Reduces the Risk of Secondary Injuries. This retrospective single-center cohort compared conventional lit rehabilitation to a program alternating lit and dark conditions, less than 10 lux, beginning at 4 months post-anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, with concomitant anterolateral ligament reconstruction, enrolling 503 patients with 446 analyzed, 372 in conventional rehabilitation and 131 in darkness rehabilitation, with mean follow-up of 5.8 years. This extends the Moon cohort and Webster and Feller epidemiology data on contralateral anterior cruciate ligament injury, reported at 10 to 15% at 5 years, by demonstrating that a specific sensory deprivation rehabilitation strategy may modulate that risk. One limitation: self-selection of rehabilitation group is the critical flaw. Unmeasured confounders, including compliance, training volume, coach quality, and psychological readiness, cannot be excluded. Dark environment rehabilitation after anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction reduced contralateral anterior cruciate ligament rupture rate from 13.1 to 5.7% at mean 5.8 year follow-up, with no significant difference in ipsilateral graft re-rupture. Moving on, Hegazi and colleagues published in JHS, titled A Classification of Extra-Articular Distal Radius Fractures with Associated Injuries. This multi-center study across three university-affiliated centers developed a hierarchical classification for extra-articular distal radius fractures, integrating four radiographic domains: fracture instability, distal ulnar fracture morphology, DRUJ disruption, and carpal involvement. The study identified 1,239 extra-articular DRFs from 3,784 radiographs, with an 80-case reliability cohort reviewed by six observers. This extends the work of LaFontaine and colleagues. One limitation: the classification has no demonstrated correlation with treatment selection, surgical outcomes, or complication rates, limiting its current utility beyond descriptive and research purposes. A new four-type, eight-subtype classification for extra-articular distal radius fractures achieved Cohen's kappa of 0.75 to 0.88 across all subtypes in multicenter reliability testing. Moving on, Scanaliato and colleagues published in AJSM, titled Failure Rates of Superior Labrum Anterior to Posterior Repair Compared with Subpectoral Biceps Tenodesis for Young Military Patients with Type 2 Superior Labrum Anterior to Posterior at 10-year follow-up. This study compared arthroscopic superior labrum anterior to posterior repair versus mini-open subpectoral biceps tenodesis for Type 2 superior labrum anterior to posterior tears in active-duty military patients under 35, enrolling 48 patients, 25 undergoing superior labrum anterior to posterior repair and 23 undergoing biceps tenodesis, with mean follow-up of 146.5 months, approximately 12.2 years. This extends prior work by Chalmers and colleagues. One limitation: small sample size with non-randomized surgeon-directed treatment allocation based on bicep symptomatology creates selection bias and limits generalizability beyond the military population. At minimum 10-year follow-up, 40% of superior labrum anterior to posterior repairs failed and required revision to tenodesis, versus zero revision rate in the primary subpectoral biceps tenodesis group. Moving on, Young and colleagues published in JSES, titled Patch Augmentation for Large to Massive Rotator Cuff Tears Heal Well in Anterior Cable Disruption. This retrospective cohort of 78 patients asked whether anterior cable disruption negates the benefit of human dermal allograft augmentation in arthroscopic repair of large to massive rotator cuff tears, with mean follow-up of 39 months. This extends prior work by Shea and colleagues. One limitation, the disrupted cable group is underpowered to detect a clinically meaningful difference in re-tear rate between groups. Human dermal allograft patch augmentation for large to massive rotator cuff tears yields a 7.7% overall re-tear rate at mean 39 months, with no significant difference between intact anterior cable at 6.1% and disrupted anterior cable at 10.3%. Moving on, Nasrat and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction with Hamstring Autograft with Graft Diameter Over 8 mm Utilizing Independent Femoral Tunnel Drilling in Age-Appropriate Patients Yields Low Failure Risk. This study evaluated revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction rates across four graft types in 1,731 patients from a prospective institutional registry from 2012 to 2023. All reconstructed with independent femoral tunnel drilling and no extra-articular augmentation, with mean follow-up of 5.5 years. This extends the Moon cohort data, which identified graft diameter and patient age as independent predictors of hamstring autograft failure, by demonstrating that achieving greater than 8 mm hamstring diameter with independent tunnel drilling specifically mitigates failure risk. One limitation, graft type was not randomly assigned, and marked age differences between groups may confound comparisons. Hamstring autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with graft diameter greater than 8 mm using independent femoral tunnel drilling achieved a 3.3% revision rate at mean 5.5 years, with allograft carrying a 2.47-fold higher revision risk versus hamstring on multivariable analysis. Moving on, Thompson and colleagues published in JSES, titled Biomechanical Changes After Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty, a Systematic Review of Advanced Measurement Technologies. This systematic review of 24 Level 3 studies from 1985 to 2025, 10 cohort and 14 case control, used motion capture, EMG, IMU, and accelerometry data to characterize biomechanical adaptations after reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. This extends prior clinical outcome literature on reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. One limitation, implant design heterogeneity, lateralization, inclination, offset, across included studies prevents any conclusions about how specific construct parameters influence the observed compensatory biomechanical patterns. Reverse total shoulder arthroplasty restores forward elevation primarily through compensatory scapulothoracic upward rotation rather than glenohumeral mechanics, with glenohumeral contribution, axial rotation, and scapulohumeral rhythm remaining reduced versus contralateral or healthy controls across all 24 included studies. Moving on. Barth and colleagues published in JOT, titled A Tibial Osteotomy of the Medial Collateral Ligament Insertion to Improve Visualization of the Medial Tibial Plateau, a Cadaveric Study. This cadaveric study